Welcome to the Laugh Factory Chicago Live with Ian Ellis, Kimberly Marion, and Leroy Hicks. In this episode, we pick up with part two from last week's episode with Corey Smith. And now we're joined by Sarah Gallagher. Sarah is a very interesting person. She's traveled around the world a lot. She has a lot of incredibly interesting things to say. And it gets a little bit heated, you know, talking about feminism, men's rights, women's rights, all that. So pay attention. Let us know what you think in the comments section. Sorry, this episode is a little bit late this week. KB and I were up in Toronto doing some comedy shows, but we're back and we're ready to bang it out. If you go to With Apologies, there's a live podcast of me and KB with the With Apologies podcast. And then I have a roast coming up June 9th at the Whip Theater. So get excited about that. Start sharing it. Tickets are available. $5 tickets. It's on Thursday night. If you buy tickets to that show, you get into the next show for free. So check out the Whip Theater and get ready for the roast of Ian Ellis. You can follow me on Twitter at Chicago Open Mic. You can follow KB at K Marion Comedy. You can follow Leroy at WhySoFunny1. And you can follow the Laugh Factory Chicago at LaughFactory_CH.
Peace!
They brought it back two times?
Well, the show that he runs now is The Last Man Standing. Same fucking show, just instead of having sons, he has daughters.
Oh, really?
Same goddamn
Wait, is
show.
Is The Last Man Standing the one where he, fuck, what's that guy's name? Forte?
Oh. Will Forte?
Yeah, is.
No,
oh, Last Man on Earth.
Yeah, that's Last Man on Earth.
Which is it based off Why the Last Man, the comic book? No, these are questions that don't need answers.
No, is that the comic book where it wipes out all the Y chromosomes? Okay, so my roommate was telling me this, and I'm like, cool. I love how in a world where there are literally only two men and all women, the two main characters still manage to be men in the comic book world.
It's from their perspective.
It is.
Right, but it's just like, he's like, it's really cool. It's like, now all of a sudden, like, the president has to be a woman, and like, all the CEOs have to be women, da, da, da. And I'm like, okay, but like, but there are presumably 3.5 billion people on Earth. We're going to talk about
the two guys.
The two dudes.
Do we want to lead off with feminism? Let me say welcome back to the Laugh Factory podcast. We took a brief break. We are now joined by a new guest, Ms. Sarah Gallagher.
Hi.
Yo.
And we still got Leroy and Corey.
Yo, hey. Yo, yo.
And we've continued celebrating the holiday. It's been an eventful night. As we were walking out, you were frustrated or annoyed with Leroy's question toward Corey about getting that hot snatch off of comedy.
Hot snatch.
That's how we put
smashing
it.
That mad puss. You weren't
smash
happy.
Smash that mad puss.
So how did you take it? And then we'll sort of recap the
it's
conversation.
It's not so much how I take it. I'm just fucking sick of all the chatter all the time, you know? It's just like constantly being assessed, constantly being rated, put on a scale from 1 to 10. Top shelf, whatever, plus, you know, and then it's like, well, when you get something, that's an object, that's a trophy. So it's like, what have you achieved? Oh, you've achieved someone who's good looking. So at that point, you're the prize. And then it's like, oh, is that how we evaluate, like, how successful you are and / how successful your relationship is? How good looking the girl is.
Relationships generally seem to be pretty hollow and based on income and moving and picking up toys like cars and boats.
Yeah. It's just like, it doesn't cut both ways. And I think if we actually, I think people talk this way so casually, and if you stop to frame it in the opposite direction, people would be like, that's ridiculous. You know? and then everyone's like, wow. I mean, historically, that's just how we view them. And I'm like, we've historically viewed a lot of people a lot of ways. And
let me say, I grew up with
it's
a lot
not
of...
all been positive.
Tried to move on from that. So just because something is historically how it's been does not mean how it should continue to be.
I grew up with a lot of female friends, and they were way more graphic than my male friends. My male friends would be like, yo, got her. Maybe want to see a picture. But my girls are like... He went down on me like this, and he's a stud, and that guy's cute, and like, behind closed doors, women are objectifying men just as much, if not more.
I was in a band with a bunch of dudes for a long time. When you're the only girl with a bunch of dudes, and your guys are all together long enough that they kind of forget that you're there, I disagree, because I've probably spent more time in groups of women than you have, and I'm not saying... that I'm not like, oh, he's super cute. That dude's super fucking hot. That dude's super hot. But it's like, I don't feel, like, I feel weird when people have, like, in the past congratulated me on how hot my boyfriend is. Or my sister will be like, oh my God, Sarah, like, somehow gets the hottest guys. And
how
I'm like,
did
first
you
of all,
that?
Fuck you. Second of all, remember that one time you got drunk and said you would kill for my face? I mean, it's just, it's constant.
But
it's
in the situation of where they forget that you're a girl, is that like, you know, it's great that that's the ultimate level of you're all equal, or you're still looking at it like, oh, by the way, I am a girl and what you guys are doing is disgusting?
I think it's just, listen, when you guys walk across the street at a red light and there are a line of cars, okay, stopped at that red light, and you're walking across it, what do you think people are looking at on you? What do you think they're thinking of you, and what do you think they're saying about
Can
you?
Can I answer this? I'm going to answer this.
Yeah.
Guys aren't. We aren't thinking about it. Yeah. We don't... Most guys don't give a shit about somebody
True.
That's in a car that
yeah.
they're never going to have a conversation
True.
With.
Yeah.
I feel like women get a lot of stares that make you aware of it that men
yeah.
don't get.
That is
yeah.
my whole point.
Right.
It's like, I can't cross the street without knowing, like, that, you know what I mean? Like, somebody on this street is, like, assessing me, possibly.
Have you
right?
always lived in a big city?
I've lived a lot of different places.
Okay.
I've lived in places, actually, where I was a really, really tiny minority. So I've definitely lived in places where I stuck out in a big way. Like, I studied in Tanzania in Eastern Africa.
Yeah.
And, like, I was doing this study, like, so far into the bush that, like, one day, like, a baby cried when she saw me because she thought it was a monster.
Wow.
And, like, they would, yeah,
really?
Like, the kids would, like, come up and, like, you know, because
wow.
I was tan and they
yeah.
would push my skin and it would turn white and then it would turn brown again.
Like, what the?
And they'd be like, why does your skin change? You know, or, like, I would just slowly feel, like, these, like, little hands in my hair. Like,
right.
Just, and in this adorable way that kids have of just being like, you're different.
Yeah. What were you doing out there?
I was studying Swahili. I was studying Kiswahili, ecological field studies, and then I did an independent study on the imposition of Rooseveltian conservation models on Maasai women.
Wow.
And I also taught on the Navajo Nation in a Bureau of Indian Affairs school, which has like an incredibly terrible history.
Yeah.
Much more recently than you would think. I mean, up until like the 70s, 80s, they were taking kids away from their families, putting them with foster families. You know, you were beaten
yeah.
if you spoke Navajo at school, but you were never really taught English. So there's this whole lost generation
like
without literacy
type.
Skills.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, and you know, it was at a boarding school, which have, you know, it's military surplus, like barracks, basically,
yeah.
and three hots and a cot,
yeah.
and you get,
yeah.
you know, the lot of these kids hitchhike, you know, on Monday.
Let me go back to the street corner.
Yeah.
Because when I hear you say that, I feel like you don't want to live in the real world.
No.
Because I see black, I see white, I see gay, I see hot,
sure.
I see not.
Yeah. But I want to live in a world where we stop and actually think about how casually we look at somebody. So I feel like it's interesting to have to convince somebody that these things, A, exist, B, are kind of a problem, and C, have really negative effects on
people's lives. This feels like a very similar conversation to me to, like, I want to live in a world where people don't believe in God. Like, you know, you could rationalize that,
I'm thinking
but
similar.
There's quite a diversity of culture and views. And
no, I want to live in a world where women aren't stifled and feel limited in what they're able to achieve because of superficial things, and I know that that has a serious effect on a lot of people's
I think good-looking people, whether you're male or female, have some sort of advantage when it comes to public view.
Mm-hmm.
It is a little bit easier for just a good-looking guy or a good-looking girl throughout life, how you're treated by strangers, how you're treated by someone at the gas station, how you're treated by someone at the bank.
Mm-hmm.
It's all slightly enhanced to give you a less grounded version of what real life actually is.
Yeah.
Right, but
when you're focused on, And you said you felt like an outcast in a lot of different spots because yeah. you were the only person.
I felt highly visible. I've been in places where I've been super highly visible.
So you don't think you've ever yeah. shut that off?
A 6-foot right. woman in Africa?
No, yeah. No, I mean, that.
And that's the
my
reason
entire
that
life
I
was highly visible.
Right, and that's the reason I asked you if you were always in a city. Because right. I feel like if you were less the minority, because everybody in Chicago looks different.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different styles out here. There's different yeah. kinds of people. There's great. Different walks of life. You're not traveling around about.
Yeah.
I am traveling around Chicago. It but is the most segregated city.
It's segregated.
So like
but there are still a ton of different kinds of people. You take the train, you see a ton of different kinds of people, different shapes, different sizes. And I think the people that are born in a city like Chicago might not necessarily view things the same way you're viewing them because of their background.
I think that women, I think there's no women who can sit there and say that the way they've been talked about, treated, perceived, told to think about themselves has not had real effect on major life decisions.
And
I think it's interesting if we frame this in a way that we already accept, such as like race or something else, we wouldn't like push back on that. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's just so funny because not now, right? And when you say we were talking earlier, like, well, historically that's just how things have been. I'm like, yeah, but we've really continued to try to work past that in other areas. But this seems to be an area where people really just don't want to acknowledge, like, my experience, the experience of a lot of women I know. I'm writing a one-woman show about it right now. On just literally, like, the major life choices I've made because of, you know, how I looked at the time or how people reacted to me at the time or how people wanted me to be at the time. I guess what I'm trying to tell you three guys is this is a really big thing. It's a right. big thing to every woman I know. It's things we talk about. And it's like, can you guys just accept that for me, this is my experience?
No, that's definitely cool. I think that's dope. What's the name of the show going to be?
It's called Enfant Terrible.
Say it one more time.
So, are you familiar with the term Enfant Terrible?
No, it sounds French.
It is French.
Okay.
So it literally means like terrible child.
Okay.
So it's sort of this exaggerated name for a super precocious child, right? Like this child who says things that like you're not supposed to say, you know, and
naughty,
outspoken, precocious. But I'm gonna call it en fait instead of en fait terrible, and about just like what being different, you know, being taller, getting boobs before everybody. Being like, you know, my dad was a football player and
your story.
People being afraid of like me wanting to eat, me being terrified of foodies even as a little girl. And this, I'm not alone here.
No, you're not.
So
no,
I just want people to stop and think about the things we talk about so casually. The things we see so casually and don't even take notice. You know, the sportscasters versus, you know, the men, the newscasters. Even just how women are dressed on TV, like their wardrobe. Mm-hmm. You know, you are in a skin-tight sheath dress. He is in a suit and up to the neck, down to the heels.
But you're specifically pointing at one problem in an industry that's filled with a million other problems as well.
Right.
Right. So when you look at the kind of people that are running a Fox News,
right,
look at Fox News at first, then you look at what their whole entire goal is, and
right,
then you look at the kind of people that run that,
right,
there are a million shady things going on there.
For sure.
And that one thing that you're specifically focused on bothers you because I think it is ingrained in our culture to care about self-interest and also to make people aware of your struggles, But I think everybody's got their own individual thing. Because a lot of things that you just said, I'm not a woman, and I can completely relate with you with being the tall kid or the frumpy kid or being aware that I'm the only person that's going up for seconds on pizza right now. You know what I mean? Like, that's something that I can relate to because it's my self-interest.
Absolutely.
So you, I don't think you can get mad at men when they haven't maybe taken the time to realize what it is like for someone that's not in their position as a black guy or as a white guy in a hoodie.
I'm pointing things out. I'm using this as an example.
Oh, no, yeah,
right, right. Man.
Well,
right.
You just said you can't get mad at men. Well, I think I can be mad at the status quo, you know? And it's interesting that people are not cool with that. Like,
let me disagree with that.
Yeah.
But uneducated.
Well,
I think men, from your perspective, are just uneducated.
I'm not just talking about men, though. Right. I mean, you are seeing me saying it's us versus you, it's men who do this. There's a market for it. And I think that we need to sit and really challenge that. And I think that's only going to happen from bold moves being taken.
But I want to challenge this idea of creating a safe space universally, because it's like, you're deciding what's a safe space for a woman. You're deciding what a woman is. I think you're giving them too much credit. You're allowing them to have control of your self-esteem when we should be teaching you, you are who the fuck you say you are, and what they say...
Well, I think if we frame this differently in a different way, like, it would really sound ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, do you want to speak to that?
I mean, I agree. I mean, my whole interpretation is just, you do have a point where the way we look and how sometimes how we view women, but the bigger picture is you guys keep on moving forward. Like, look at all the advances that you guys do make. Like, these are minor setbacks. We all get stones thrown at us. But look at Oprah. Like, you get in a position.
I got to take her side on this.
Yeah, I disagree. I really disagree.
There's pushback right now there's been a boil up with racism in the last couple of years with the police.
Always.
But if you look at the movement for women and the movement for, like, black men, black women, for example, in the 60s, the black culture has been way farther advanced and pushed forward ahead of the woman culture.
If women start thinking about themselves differently, the world will be forced to reckon with them being different.
That's what she's arguing for right now.
Part of the 60s
is the opportunity and the equality to do
so. I'm not giving power. My whole point is that I shouldn't have to daily fight the messages and the stares and everything that's crammed down my throat. And that's not me being unrealistic. It's not me being mad at men. That's not me being judgmental. That's not me being saying the rest of the world needs to be a safe space for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's really interesting that, like, if we stop and think about, like, the messages. So Oprah did this episode where these little girls were given dolls, and there were white girls and black girls, and there were white dolls and black dolls, and the black girls chose white baby dolls, and because they said they were prettier. Okay, if we stop to frame this in a sense of, like, listen, black people, it's just up to you to not let other people make you feel bad or get down on yourself, and this is historically how things have been, and you're bringing up one instance where things are like this, but it's really a bigger industry. And I would say, well, it's the bigger industry. That's the problem. You know what I mean? I would say, secondly, we're comfortable with challenging the way that people are portrayed. We're comfortable with feeling challenged, being challenged on the things we say or think about people racially, and we're not really comfortable with that. With gender.
I think it's more important to change women than it is to change the things attacking women. Because part of the 60s, the way I interpreted it was like black people learning self-esteem and learning a new identity and then saying, this is who the fuck we are, and then the world having to deal with that. If you're just going to go after every sexist thing or every...
No, but women had to do that too. But I mean, there is really a constant, and there was a huge blowback. Huge blowback.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, in the 80s. I mean, if you look at a lot of the...
I'm not about to pick it up.
Should we just answer and put this person on the spot?
No, it's okay. It's okay. I'm not about to pick it up.
And even how we cover... Say what you will about whether you like Hillary, don't dislike her, whatever. I mean, when you look at the coverage of her,
mm-hmm.
especially in like 2008, you know, versus the coverage of male people.
Times have changed.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're still like, sorry, you're too loud, you know. You have a voice, that's a problem. I guess I just feel like it's interesting to have to how much pushback you get for just being like, can we just get judged based on being intelligent, being whatever, what our hard work ethic, whatever, you know? And it's like, when if like Leroy said that, like, we'd be like, yeah, man, totally. Yeah. You know? And if I say it, you're like, well, historically, good-looking women do get this, whatever. And, like, I have been very good-looking before. Like, when I was, like, before I did comedy, I was a really, you know, a lot better, like, a hot musician. People were trying to scout me for plus-size modeling, and I was 70 pounds skinnier, which tells you something about the industry. Like, I know what that is like, you know?
I want to kind of put an analogy out there and then put your mind at ease a little bit about how guys process things. But can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What is the one thing that's most pleasurable to view to you? A sunset, an ocean, an animal. What's the most pleasurable thing for you to view?
A high desert landscape.
For almost all guys, it's a pretty woman.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like kittens.
Hang on.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is. For me personally, yeah. I love a great landscape. I loved living in the mountains. I loved being on the beach.
Right.
All that is gorgeous. I can take it in and accept it, and I know it is beautiful. But none of that compares to a really pretty woman that I find attractive.
Yeah.
On the flip side, if I peripherally see a pretty woman on the street, I go all the way out of my way to avoid any kind of eye contact.
Yeah.
I avoid any kind of, I hope he doesn't rape me. I hope he doesn't murder me.
Right.
That's how I think when I process a pretty woman on the street.
Yeah.
I want to not make her feel uncomfortable.
Exactly.
That's interesting, though, because we kind of are now raising our boys to think of themselves as like either perceived or actual potential attackers and women as potential victims. It's like, I don't walk down the street being like, I might get raped. You know what I mean?
Right.
And like, if you look at every pretty woman you see and you're like, that girl could get raped. And secondly, being pretty, rape's a crime of power, not attraction.
Some little kid that pushed over a girl and had to go home and go, Bob, am I a rapist? I pushed Susie.
But, you know, I want to get back to the way that women need to think about themselves. And I feel like you can't sit there and tell women from a young age that, like, your value is in your looks. That, you know, good girls have good handwriting. They're nice. They're people-pleasing. You know, they look like what's on Nickelodeon and then what's on MTV and then what's on, you know, whatever. You know, and so you can't sit there and tell girls that their value comes in their ability to provide arousal. They're a collection of sex holes. If you don't sleep with the guy, he's friend-zoned in. So you didn't give them what they want. You know, being your friend is second best, is the consolation prize. And then blame them when they take you at your word. So, yeah, there are a lot of girls who grow up and are like, I'm a model. I'm going to be a trophy wife. Who I marry will be my greatest achievement. But I do think that, like, we need to really think about the messages that you see. Like, every image of an airbrushed person used to sell something. I think if you swap that out with a very unhealthy, airbrush-looking man used to sell random shit, you'd be like, that's fucking weird. And we don't think about that.
I think I'm just going to add my two cents. I got two beautiful daughters, one 9 and the other one 5. So how I view it, I tell my daughters to be strong. We just don't look at beauty. I tell them that they're very unique. I tell them things that are really important, not about sex and do this. It's more about controlling one's emotion and understand bad things happen to good people and learn to pick yourself up and keep moving yourself forward. I think the real target area that we need to hit at is our kids growing up.
Yeah.
Because you're right, on Disney is so much out there and they're portraying this. But I tell my girls, I love them being them. And that's if they're quirky and they want to be a nerd and read a book, be a nerd and read a book. It's okay to be you. Like, That's my bigger picture out of it. But if we raise our kids to be up that way, we're good. But a lot of these girls don't have father figures.
What you're fighting against, I think, is... So say advertising or consumer culture.
Right.
Advertising is a science.
It's the business, though.
And propaganda is a science. That and that science preys on the animal that you are. You're in a fancy building and you're wearing clothes and you think that you're a monkey. Yeah. And people know how to stimulate monkeys.
I know, but I just think that, like, making the argument of what we are and where we are is not a valid argument for where we should be. And so I think
also,
that
I'm
these
not saying that we shouldn't change things. I'm just saying that's what it is.
No, I know, but you know, there's work. There's a lot of work to do, and you can parse it out towards we're all just animals. We have no control over anything, whatever. But you know, we've moved forward in a lot of ways, and I think that it's weird that we're like a lot of people aren't willing to A, accept that these are major issues, B, like accept that they could be changed. And C, accept like their own role in it. So I just think it's little things. Like when you hold a baby girl, you're like, hey pretty girl, you know, and you know, when
but
a little
what
girl
would
you
say
like,
to a kid instead? Like,
well, you know,
oh,
like,
you realized human being.
Yeah,
you
I mean it's
have the potential to
but I think it's really interesting. I mean, when you really look at studies about, for example,
I mean I,
people
well, no.
getting conditioned away from sciences and comedy. Girls stop making the same number of jokes as boys in kindergarten.
Well, yeah,
because,
linguistically,
like,
I can break that down.
You're an attention whore if you're a loud, funny girl, and you're the class clown if you're a loud, funny boy.
This can go into a broader conversation about women in comedy.
Yeah, change the mind frame. Like, I just... Somehow you gotta change that. I don't think everybody looks at it on that level, because I don't. Like, when I was a little kid, I'm a class clown, and I didn't think she was a whore because she was a class clown.
Attention
whore. Yeah, right. You're in fourth grade, right? I wouldn't look at it like that. I'm just like, oh, she has jokes. I got jokes. I think you're looking at it very deep, and because there is
I'm
an
looking
issue.
At it socially.
Well,
I think
let me give some science behind that. So
I'm
there's
at
linguists,
studies, yeah.
Deborah Tanning. They have
the
broke down. Well, men are taught through our culture to communicate in terms of like one up and one down. And it's aggressive. It's evolution. You're fighting with each other to be the dominant or alpha male.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas women are taught to nurture and incorporate everybody in the group. And so, linguistically, from a young age, women are taught, like, don't insult people. Like, bring them in. Nurture them. Whereas men are like, I gotta be better than you. I gotta be sharper than you. I gotta be faster than you.
Right. So that's learned. And it's the same way that we've sort of... We have a lack of women in advanced science positions. You know what I mean? And it's and people then use the fact that you condition people away from it. And then you use their lack of representation in that field to say that they can't do it. So it's like we condition black people away from reading for a long time.
I was gonna say,
and then what are you going to say? Like, black people
shit.
Can't read because you've, on purpose, we're like, well,
how do we get them? The white man's
read.
Genius.
Yeah.
So it's really circular logic. And, you know, also individuals may not see it or act this way, or that may not be their experience, but it's enough of experience to be like statistically very viable. And it's really frustrating continuing to hear the argument of like, women aren't funny because they don't need to be, men are funny because it's to get, evolve or whatever. And it's like, dude, every guy I've ever met thinks he's hilarious, and very few of them are. And of all of the hilarious women I know, very few of them realize they're funny. Like, the funniest people I know are women.
What I think we can take away from this is that you're seeing the programming. And you're not happy with it.
I agree.
So changing the programming is maybe, you know, part of step one. Or,
well, right.
Well, part
and that's
of this longer
process.
About,
and that's
else.
What I try to...
But I don't never... You know. I don't know. Conversations like that, I just really don't talk to people about, because now we're breaking it down to a whole nother level. Our job is just to make them laugh. Fuck if it's a woman, if it's a black, if it's a white, if it's an Asian, take the color and the sex away. Our job is just to make them laugh. So I walk away from conversations like that where I don't think women are as funny as guys. Like, no, man, that's not what we're supposed to be talking about here. But
I mean, I think we're supposed to be talking about what
we've done a great job of focusing
exactly.
on Corey, who we're supposed to be talking to and talking about.
Hey, oh, no. I was
thought
just
this
saying
was my
the,
time.
No, it definitely was. It definitely was. You brought a lot of good insight. Like, I'm very interested to see your show because there's so much passion. You have so much. you have so much passion for this project. It sounds like it's going to be good.
One of my favorite albums, music or comedy of all time, is Killing Them Softly.
Okay.
Because I feel like it is exactly what I want comedy to be. I want it to be thought-provoking, and I really want people to take things that we don't think about or we see casually or we casually accept as reality and stop and be like, oh, shit, I never thought about that, you know? And Killing Them Softly was, what, like 16, 17 years ago, right? And to me, like, that's what I aspire to. I aspire to write comedy that addresses these things in a way that he wrote an entire album that addressed the very real effect that being black growing up in D.C. and just being a man in this world.
Being real.
Yeah.
And not giving a fuck.
That's so much more valuable to me than like...
It is. It's our story that's so valuable.
And so much funnier to me. And
I'm going
to
ask all three of you this question and then I'm going to sneakily leave and come back. Trinity in comedy? Meaning like the comic you liked the most before you started doing comedy and then the most influential on you and then the one that like, oh, that's how you do it. The one that like you're looking forward to.
Yeah.
That's so deep, man.
Or you could just do your top five, but you know, I like the Trinity.
In a row, the Seinfeld, Mark Maron, Bill Burr.
You've got to unpack that.
I could see that. I mean, I feel like that's
in the order that you that you presented it. Seinfeld
before
Mark
you
Maron.
Started, like on your style and what you want to be.
Yep.
Is Bill Burr.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's fascinatingly interesting because you're looking at like somebody who's a phenomenal performer and that attracted you to it, and then you're like, oh, I want the he wants the rawness of Maron. But now that you've been through the rawness, you're looking at the professionalism of Burr. Is that
just the
like the pacing of him?
He's a workhorse, man, and his stuff is so jam packed tight, and you can't find a single comic out there that's like he slacked off on that. You know, like I feel like Bill Burr's last album really slipped. Like you're not gonna find people whether you like Bill Burr or not. Mm-hmm. He's Bill Burr, and he puts out really solid shit that he believes is funny, and it usually is.
So, from like a structural tools like tradesman point of view, Bill Burr
as a craftsman. Bill Burr is definitely what I aspire to be as a comedian in the future.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
What about you?
You know what? I should probably go last.
I know. I was thinking about mine. Corey, were you going to add anything?
Well, I was just going to say, Seinfeld beforehand,
was it from the show or the stand-up?
You know, I've always been a stand-up fan, and I thought he was all right, and I liked the show.
Right.
I went and saw him do a college show. I'm 32.
Okay.
I went and saw him do a college show before I started doing comedy. And, I mean, right when he came back, and he lit that place on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he did very, very well.
220-year-olds.
But what I saw right before I started doing comedy was Comedians in Cars had just come out.
And then
I started watching him on Stern.
Yeah.
And the one thing that I really liked about Jerry Seinfeld is his advice to comedians about comedy and how real he was about it. I enjoyed him very much.
Yep. Inspiring.
He definitely pulls the curtain back, which I appreciate.
Yeah,
he does.
Really honest about stuff.
He brings it right here.
Yeah, he's like you in that he is like obsessed with the trade. And I heard him once say he considers himself more like an athlete than an artist.
Get up, sometimes.
Throw your free throws every day, do 100 free throws.
Go run them 5 miles.
Do your mile. Yeah, and just show up and practice every day. Yep. Keep in shape.
I agree.
You know,
Give
attention to it. Yeah.
But he's right, though.
Yeah.
Those are the same principles that we have to apply in our everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
So if you apply it to comedy, it's the truth.
Right.
You know what I
mean? But I think people have this sort of, like, idea of the mad artist that, like,
that
you know,
within.
Handel wrote The Messiah in, like, one 40-hour session, you know? Or, you know, but then there are other...
sometimes it does come like that.
It's true.
You know, depending if you're driving with the right people and there's good vibes, like sometimes you can come up with something within a half an hour and it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, but I think what I've also heard is there's something to be said for like a opening a daily dialogue with the world. And if you, that just means like, and this is something that I struggle with, is if you start and you write a little bit every day, you've like opened the dialogue, right? And right. You've sort of like gone to work that day. And our work is weird and it looks different than everybody else. But like you've gone to work that day, you can go about your day and you've just opened that conversation.
Right.
And the vast majority of that conversation, God knows, hopefully no one will ever read, but it sort of puts you in that frame of mind.
How I would like to say it, because I feel the Seinfeld reference as an athlete.
Yeah.
The brain is a muscle.
It is.
The more you work that out, the more in shape it's going to be and ready for the next task. Yep. Whether that's writing every morning, whether that's working out, like that's to do something with your brain that involves a craft that you enjoy.
Yeah.
If you put that work in just to get those juices flowing,
man,
you're going to get more out of it later.
Boy, you really will.
You will.
Yeah.
You will.
And it's like, I find myself...
being in shape. Comedy
exactly,
shape.
Exactly.
I find myself being like distracted because I think it's so much easier to... I'm coming off of two surgeries and I have a partially torn MCL right now. I was a Whitewater River guide when I was young. I'm a mountain biker, everything. So like I had a ton of shit that I had to fix. And I'm training to get back into shape right now.
That's good.
And it's so much easier for me to just get into shape physically or spend some time getting into shape musically, playing instruments, writing, whatever. Or getting better at the New York Times crossword puzzle that I do like two of every day. And I find it to be a distraction because those are really concrete things that I can sit there and be like, I have 20 minutes, I'll go like work on this Beethoven piece. Or I'll write, you know, more of my music album or something. I'll just jam around a little bit.
That's good.
And to me, I feel like I get a little bit stifled by perfectionism with writing in a way that I don't with other things.
Yeah, you're right. Because we want to be perfect.
And it's very nebulous, too. Yeah.
Well, you know what KB told me? She was like, just throw up on the page. Whatever, whatever's in your mind at the time, write it down. Get the juices flowing. Just write down your ideas.
Yeah.
Take a couple days. And I learned this from Big Sean.
Take
a couple days. Come back. See what the fuck you wrote. Be like, this doesn't make no sense. Wait a minute. And it's like playing connect the dots.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, and those dots can take years.
Yeah.
Years.
I found something in a notebook a couple months ago.
Dusted
and it was my first notebook.
That's
and I was
what I'm saying. Like
this
is
I never
genius.
Did that because I didn't.
Exactly.
But there was something there. Yeah. And then I finally got it.
Or have you ever written something not with intent
right
to be comedian, like comedic, and then gone? Like, I've written out a rant. I pulled over and I just wrote this rant about, like, just all the bullshit I had heard about women that day. And this was years ago. And I was just like, and nobody think, you know what I mean? And it was, I literally was like typing on my phone, just like ranting. And then maybe a year later, it turned into like a 3-minute sort of feminist bit on Bukkake. It's like the only like gross joke that I have, but it's like to make a point.
Right.
Yeah. I had to change it to gangbang for Zany's once. It kind of
we
lost
don't
its punch.
Know what Bukkake is.
It was like, I can't imagine.
What's another word you
could
use?
Gangbang?
Jamie, I feel like, would be fine with it. I literally remember being on the phone with my friend John.
Cum dumpster?
In LA, being like, hey, buddy, like, and I asked XL this. I asked my friend John Boy and then XL at the same outside of Zany's being like, all right, like on a scale of 1 to 10, like where would you put gangbang versus Bukkake? And they were like, Gallagher, don't do the bet. And I was like, I'm going to do the bet.
I don't think Chappelle said that speaks to that point. Is he said, write everything down because you have great ideas now, but you don't have the muscles to express them.
Yeah.
You go back and you realize.
Or you changed mindsets.
Right.
The one thing that I noticed when I put pen to paper is sometimes it doesn't come out properly.
It doesn't.
Or while you're doing that process, you just switched mind frames, and you need to come back when you're feeling funny and analyze what you wrote down later.
Yeah. Speaking when you're creating juices up.
Right.
Or you grow the
Two
fuck up and you're like,
brain.
I'm not just going to make a cheap joke.
Right.
Like this joke, something I tweeted 5 years ago, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I fucking said that. And it was just to be like an asshole, you know? And you're like, well, that's out there. I'm going to have to deal with that one day, you know? But like people, you just grow the fuck up. And you're like, no. I took a step when I first was going through the process to get past at Laugh Factory years ago. I kind of sort of like, on my 10-minute set, I came in and I just kind of like tanked it. Jamie totally called me on it. Was totally right. I took months off comedy Because I was like, I'm not saying what I want to say. Yeah. This isn't, like, my point that I want to make.
Not your voice.
Yeah, and I was like, I feel like there are things that I really want to talk about, and I haven't written that material yet. And I've walked away from comedies for big chunks of time before for various reasons. And it's funny, I went through this, like, horrible, crippling depression where I could barely hold down a job for, like, 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then I, like, Facebooked Curtis, and I was like, hey, man, can I come do the mic? And then it just was done. Like, was passed. And I, because so, I was saying what I meant.
Yeah.
It was way more vulnerable. It was, I think, stuff I think is important to talk about.
Yeah. It's a different perspective. And that's what it is.
But that is also a very specific branch or lineage of comedy to, like, I want to say something. I want to affect you in a way.
Yeah.
What is some of the effect you want to have? Like, you could pick a bit or just, like, in general to your voice.
Yeah.
What is it you're trying to express?
And I always think of Chappelle and, like, other comics who do it. I'm like, I, you know, don't want to be... I mean, I hate talking about other... I don't know. Whatever. Like, think about, like, Andrew Dice Clay in the 80s or Lisa Lampanelli or, you know, just, like, where you're just, like, up there just saying shit to get a reaction. And that stuff doesn't fly anymore because what was controversial and made people Twitter back then were like, okay, cool, so Lisa, you caught two big black dicks. Awesome. Like, we're like, what is that? That's like lunch talk with the ladies. Like, what used to be this shocking, like, she was out there. You're just like, oh, cool,
true.
So your boyfriend's black. That's awesome.
We knew it.
Cool.
This brings up a point of, like, vulnerability, I guess, is the edginess now, and it's not saying these awful things, because we've heard everything. We've seen South Park.
Yeah.
It's, where's the vulnerability underneath it?
I think new comics think talking about sex, jerking off, taking a shit, whatever. And it's women feeling like they have to talk about how slutty and fat they are, and men talking about jerking off or whatever. Like, it's like this false sense of vulnerability where you're saying, like, look at me, like, I'm putting it out there. I'm talking about, but I'm like, that's not, you're saying, look at this, like, thing that's not really that vulnerable.
There's definitely
really
those
vulnerable
trophies where, like, I've heard people say, like, I finally got my N-word bit. And, like, that was a thing you were striving for?
Right.
Like, that was on your checklist of, like, now I'm an edgy comic. I've finally got it in.
I finally get
found
to drop
a way to get away
N-bomb
with it.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I always think, man, we think too much about it. Because I know I wasn't thinking about that. I was just like, all right, I got my jokes. Let me go out there and see if it hits. I didn't think about, oh, I got my N-word. I got my Caucasian joke. I feel like when you first start off with comedy, like, those are the things that we gravitate to because we feel like it's so easy and so universal.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, man, oh, everybody jerks off. Ah.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Everybody has a black friend, but I don't know. That's how
I do. Do you think in terms of writing jokes? Like, is that what you... Because I do not at all. And when I start... And it was me and a bunch of dudes, and they were, like, geeking out about joke structure and shit. I'm like, I don't think like that. I just write down... I think of it... Like, writing almost like a monologue that's funny. And it's kind of like the way that my stuff's set up. I don't sit there and think about, like, I'm going to write jokes.
Are you married to that monologue when you get up there?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I do a lot of, like, off-the-cuff stuff. And it's punchline. Like, there's a laugh at the end of each thing. But I get grossed out by really transparent, jokey. I hate when people say, I did this joke in Annapolis. I'm like, no, you've never done that joke before. This is, you're thinking of it right now.
Yeah.
Like, that's, I hate when people say, this next joke's about, this joke's called. I'm like, no, these aren't jokes. You're up there just being a funny person. Like, that's the stagecraft.
Right.
Like, why are you showing, you're showing the hand?
Well,
and people just get up and, like, launch into it.
A lot of people.
Or, like, set up punchlines. And I'm like, what are you really trying to say? It feels icky to me.
What? Why are you being so judgmental? Just a question. Like, do you, like, because when I go to comedy shows, I see the people that I really want to see. You know, then I find myself in a corner probably going over my bit, getting my head right. I really don't judge it. As long as people are laughing, more power to them, because I know the struggle, like, we came so far in this game, like, going up every night, working a job, doing this. You told me about your injuries and all of that. Like, shit ain't, this is not easy. Chicago, like, we have to support ourselves. Like, everybody know we have to do
two
jobs
and
do comedy. 4 o'clock in the morning, you're producing your own shit. You don't know where you're going to sleep at. Like, you got bills. Like, shit is real.
Let's start with Corey, and this comes back to the question I was going to ask before we left. From my point of view, the audience doesn't give a fuck about your artistic bullshit, whatever, however skilled you are.
Yeah.
They just want to have a good time. They just want to break from life.
Period.
But you have an idea in your head, and I have an idea, and you have an idea of what a comic's comic is, or what it means to really do this shit, mm-hmm. to, like, actually hit yeah. a higher level. Yeah. What is that idea in your head of, like, oh, I'm really doing it. Like, I'm doing the real work.
Kobe.
About the comic's comic thing, or what do you mean?
Either what is a comic's comic to you, or, like, is there something where you go, like, oh, that's... I don't want to use the word hack, but it's like, oh, that's easy. That's widgets. They're just writing fucking jokes, and that's someone that knows who they are.
That was what I was point I was trying to make.
The comics comic is someone that's got it all, that can make at least everybody at some point go, oh, damn it. that.
Yeah.
But doesn't have to be enjoyed by everybody in a room. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
they don't. They're not doing that hacky shit no. that's going to get that low hanging fruit.
No,
laugh.
Right. No,
they're doing that stuff that's gonna make true comedy fans exactly. go, oh shit, that's funny, exactly. and get them.
I agree.
And like the taste level of comedy good fans job. Has changed.
Yeah.
Well, so complete, it's not a judgmental thing. It's a my. Yeah. I guess it's my taste yeah. is what I was trying to say.
Oh, yeah,
and that's
okay.
the thing. We all have okay. tastes.
Yeah,
like,
we do.
I prefer certain people yeah. over others, certain styles over others, certain subjects over others. And it is being a little cunty, being like, oh, you just said yeah. I dealt that joke before. Yeah. But that's just my thing. I just feel like that's
okay.
that's not the magic of it. Like, our job is not to sit here and be like, I am doing my set for you. Our job is to get up there and just be like, create this illusion of a conversation where you really shouldn't be talking. I have a microphone and I'm mm-hmm. set 6 feet above mm-hmm. you. Right? Mm-hmm. And like, but nobody feels like they missed out by not getting to say anything.
Mm. Okay.
In terms of like the triggers and stuff, I think like there are people like Louis
yeah.
who set a standard and then they were like, oh, I want that N-word bit. And or like,
yeah.
there was a lot of Hedbergs for a long time, there was a lot of Attels yeah. for a long time. And I think that's, like, at the early ages what everybody gravitates toward. And that's
yeah.
why you see people, they're trying to emulate something they don't have the skills for yet.
Yeah.
Because they think that's what, like, the real work is.
Yeah.
But it's not. The real work isn't that. It's figuring out how to
your own voice.
Process your own voice.
Yeah.
For my own money. Or it's, you know, write some great fucking widgets.
There's come up also, with some great... like, this, your taste level and what you're capable of, there's this huge gap. And I'm just coming to terms with the fact that, like, the only way to get through it is to just do the fucking like work. You know?
Because
you're not going to sit here and just jump that gap
exactly.
away.
Exactly. And
yeah.
you bring up a good point, because, like, when you first come in, you have your idol, and you're going to study from your idol, whoever it is, Kevin Hart, Bill Murray, whoever you have, you're going to study from. You're going to pick up how they move around. You're going to pick up certain words that they say. And that's where the whole gap comes in.
Yeah.
You're not really them. You just started off. You're not really Kevin Hart, so you can't really make
yeah.
that transition. But like you said, you keep on putting the work. You find your own voice. You
yeah.
move away from your idol and you become your own person.
Right.
Become your own
for
hero.
You guys, was there a turning point or a moment or a set? Or you said you took a break, like something, there was a catalyst to take that break.
Yeah.
And then there was something that happened on that break where you're like, you know what, I want to get back on that horse.
Mm-hmm.
Corey, you had to have started out just fucking writing jokes, and then eventually, unless you just like, you know, went up and started, you know, trying to be you from the get-go.
No, it's a process for everybody. It's a process for everybody. I just, when you said that, I thought about the first fucking bit I did on stage, and it still hurts me. Like, I still,
yeah.
right now, I'm fucking 12 years old. And
you're like, I hope everyone in that audience has died
me.
Already.
God damn it. Like, I never want to see their faces again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
The only turning point I really had, besides putting in the actual work and realizing there isn't that immediate launch, that things come to you, it's like making a cake.
Yeah.
And you're making your own cake. And you don't
yeah.
know what cake you're making yet.
Yeah.
But as soon as you get all those ingredients in there,
yeah.
your cake's going to come out however it comes out.
Exactly.
It's going to be an armadillo. Red velvet
cake. All right, here we go. Cream cheese.
No steel magnolia fan.
But
I think that steel magnolia reference was.
There was one set that kind of changed my mindset on my capabilities. I did just a random road gig in the middle of nowhere, and the headliner didn't show up. And they're like, can you do an hour? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to do an hour for you guys.
Yeah.
And I hit a weird stride, and I did my full 15 up front. Make sure I got all in there.
Get him on your side.
So now I got 45 minutes to play.
Couldn't where save a line.
This wasn't at the Whip? Someone was telling me about this.
Yeah, no, that was all off
the Valentine's
cuff.
Show.
Yeah, no, that, no, I didn't. No, I didn't accept that with only 15 minutes. No, that's funny. That'd be me. No, I
wasn't that a week ago.
No, but I
have. Yeah, Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Right.
I did the full 15 up front, and then that's what sparked that whole 30 days. I riffed it.
Went to Cali for 30 days and just performed.
I did no LA. Material, no repeated anything, like everything off the cuff, no matter what. And the one thing that triggered during that set is, material or not, funny.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Are you funny?
Period. Yeah.
And then I watched this one thing Andy Kaufman did where he read the phone book and people were giggling.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right. Yep. So it's funny. It's not artistic.
Yeah.
But the number one goal, no matter if you have an objective and you want to say something serious.
Yeah. What is the goal?
The goal is funny.
That's our job.
Can you be funny for an hour? And I answered my question, I could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like how you got that courage. Like, you don't know what you're capable of until you're really placed in that situation. Like,
right.
You didn't know how sharp you were. You're like, damn, an hour? He's not here? Fuck it, I'm here?
You don't say no.
But in the back of your mind, you're like, how the fuck am I going to pull this off?
Yeah, I just dusted off every idea I had at the moment.
You know
and
what?
I ran with
Let's
it.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
The reason that I started with the 15 was to gain that confidence.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. And I know I can make these guys laugh.
And
I thought it was a little easier doing that new stuff because it was like, I don't know how this is going to go. It's kind of exciting.
But you guys already bought into me. You guys love me.
Yeah, you have to get them on your side. They have to believe in you.
Yeah, it wasn't the most thunderous 45 minutes you'll ever see in your life.
But they were on your side.
They didn't know.
But they didn't ask for their money back.
They didn't. Well, I got congratulated.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we'd love to have you come back.
At the end of the show.
I go, listen, I'll do a half hour when I come back.
How far were you?
How many years? I was about a year and a half in when I did that.
Yeah. I did a headlining show not too far in Milwaukee, and I started doing material, and there were like, I'm going to say generously 11 people at this show, and it was like in the basement underneath the mall, and, but our like the mall, spot. But the bad mall, like the mall that nobody goes to,
the shitty mall,
like it's like just a Foot Locker.
Yeah. Oh, you're so stupid. a whole bunch of kiosks and shit.
Yeah, but like, no, like, like they don't, just the bad mall, right? And when you tell people, like, I'm doing it, it's under this mall, and everyone was Milwaukee's like, yeah, no, we don't go to that mall.
Yeah.
Just didn't. It was like, whoa, they are not picking up what I was throwing down. So I was like, well, I have a microphone and 11 people. I'm going to give everybody a nickname. And I'm just going to talk with every single person.
Yep.
You know, and I'd be talking to this person, like, right, glitter neck? And then, right, you know, just like every, you know, and it was just like me just like playfully fucking with people.
Yeah.
And I don't love doing that. Like, I don't really love that sense of humor. I'm not into like snaps and insult comedy. But I'm like, at the end of the day, like, if that's all I can get you to go for, like, you're right. That's my job.
We got to do our job with the tools at hand. Like you said,
and you have to do your job when you're in Peoria, Illinois, as much as you're doing your job at Chuck.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
Right?
Or Benny's in the basement of the mall. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
I don't care.
Like, the alternative, like, when you do, like, you know, Chicago Underground Comedy, or you do Beat Kitchen, and everyone's there to just, like, you know, be cool and like alternative, and it's all cool young kids.
Yeah.
Versus, like, I went and did a show in, like, literally in the airport in Peoria, Illinois, and was like, all right, let's go with it. Like, you are going to disagree with some things that I say, but, like, we're going to like each other at the end of this.
Well, I heard a story. It was with Steve Harvey. He was like, man, comics, like, he was saying in his beginning stages, he was like, you're not a real comic until you go out. I forgot where he was at in Texas and did a rodeo show.
Like Amarillo and did like
he was like it was a rodeo show. He had to go out there
That's awesome. Yeah.
He was like, I don't know shit about shit, but he just went out there and told his jokes. He was like, all white people, and they just wanted, like, he was like.
Plus, there's a guy riding a bull in the corner, so saying, you gotta
overcome. You still riding? You want me to go out there now?
If he wasn't trying to look at me, yeah.
But comedy, we gotta go.
And they only have to do 8 seconds. Right. So.
I know. That's a win.
No, it is.
That is a win.
The effort gets you an applause right there. Bull riding. Oh, you were on for half a second, you got your nut ripped open.
Wow, I'm impressed.
3 seconds was a movie.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of that first set?
Well, my first set?
12-year-old Corey.
Oh, I wasn't 12 when I did it, but that's what I felt like when I was. Whenever I think of the moment I told that first bit on stage, it turns me into the most embarrassed teenage version of myself. I'm just like, oh.
You're like, why am I in sixth grade again?
It still makes my palms sweat just thinking about it. Fuck yeah, it'll haunt my dreams until I die, that first bit.
Yeah. That's awful. How it is.
So, Sarah, I want to bridge for me the gap between you seem very educated. I'm assuming you went to school. You said you went to school.
You want to get punched.
You're a good liar.
Right.
You worked with the kids. And then somewhere, comedy came into your life.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
So
you slept in.
No, it always felt like an inevitability that I sort of like tried to dance away from. So what's funny is like, I started.
I agree.
It was always like my teachers were like, "Well, you know, when you grow up to be a stand-up comedian, like when you grow up, you know." Yeah. And nobody's shocked at this turn of events, but I tried to not. Like I tried to, you know, I got a full ride to school, and I majored in Third World Studies, Africa, and the Middle East. I double minored in Environmental Studies and Music, right? And then I did Teach for America on the Navajo Reservation, and then I played music. I was, you know, playing in a band that did really pretty well. Like, we, like, headlined House of Blues and played Lollapalooza's After Party, and I was in that, and I was kind of, I was watching a friend do an open mic, and she was like, dude, you fucking need to do comedy, and in my mind, I'm like, I know, dude, I'm getting there, but I'm busy being super hot and a rock star right now, just... So.
Kiss my
killing
tits,
it.
Bitch.
So, she called, signed me up at, it was at the Loft on Lincoln, Jack Calhoun's old place. It was like a speakeasy. Do you guys remember this?
Yeah.
And it was just armchairs, people ripping cigs, just like tubs of Coors Light that Jack would buy, you know, and it was a bunch of white dudes
dropping
C-bombs and N-bombs.
Yep. Oh,
and I sat there, and it was like the late night mic, and then they're like, we have one more comic left. And they called my name, and I cold called. And I just went up. I'm like, it's 3 a.m. I was like, apparently to be funny, you have to drop fucking N, or be a white dude and drop C, whatever. And I just tore into every guy there. And like, you guys know a lot of these guys.
Yeah.
That was it. But, and so I would kind of dabble here, but I would go back to music, and I would, you know. And so, I think in the summer of, like, 2011 or 12, finished up some, like, festival dates with the band and officially, like, hopped over. And as soon as I did that, I booked Zanies for the first time. So, like, I was kind of opposite. So I feel like I was, like, the roadrunner. Like, you run off the cliff, and you're doing fine until you look down.
You're like, oh, shit.
Yeah. So I had a different voice already. Like, I didn't sound, because I didn't geek out about stand-up because I was trying to avoid it for so long.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't watch SNL for a long time because I was like, I should be doing that, but I'm not. I should be doing stand-up, but I'm not. So, I just sound different. I don't know. I just think differently, right? And so, I mean, everybody does, but I didn't feel, I wasn't
you weren't
a
fitting
nerd.
Somebody else's
I wasn't
mold.
Nerding out the way all these dudes were nerding out. And so, it went well right away. And Bert happened to be at that set and booked me for Ride the Star after that, and I just quit my band 2 weeks ago. But I started to look around, and it was when I first was dabbling, it was like Lisa, Megan, Beth was just moving, Cameron had already moved, my friend Ann Root, who doesn't do comedy anymore, and like the dudes who have been around. So it was like these are great guys, they're my friends, but it was like Bobby Butts, there's dudes, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, this is how who's going to tell me whether or not I'm funny, you know? And they were all eat, sleeping, and breathing stand-up. And they were like, well, if you don't do 14 mics a week, and if you don't write this much, and here's how a joke's supposed to be structured. And I was like, dude, am I doing this wrong? Like, I don't eat, sleep, and breathe this. I have other shit that I'm interested in. I have other emotions I want to explore.
Yeah.
I to this day, like, don't do as much stand-up as everyone around me. And people get mad at me. Like, my contemporaries are like, when I would walk away, would be like, Gallagher, why aren't you with me?
She doesn't deserve this.
No, opposite. They would be like, why aren't you getting what you deserve? They would be like, why aren't you here with me? Like, these people are killing you right now. And I would be like, sorry, I'm unable to leave my couch right now, cripplingly depressed. Please stop yelling at me. All I can do is play piano because it's the only thing that makes me feel like I'm actually doing something. But, like, I play into headphones, so nobody has to hear me, you know? And so my friends would be like, dude, why are you not... Why did you not go through Laugh Factory the first time? Like, what happened? Like, why aren't you trying... You know, why aren't you at Mike's last time? Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you headlining every show you're on?
Yeah.
And I'd be like, I don't know. I had a lot of internal shit to overcome. This brought up a lot of me. I had to grow up. I had to be like, shit, the rules apply to me.
Yeah.
Shit, I'm going to have to work hard at something the first time in my life. Shit, I'm going to have to fail at something the first time in my life. Because I was just naturally good at the one thing you have to be good at, which is school. And so I didn't have to work at that. And that's an important thing that people learn as a kid. And I didn't learn that skill. I was just like, I can just get the notes before the test.
I wanted to ask you earlier, and so this will be for everybody, and going off of that, have there been times when you felt like, I'm not doing this right, or where people have made you to feel like, oh, you're not doing it right, and then you were like, yeah, but you know what, I'm going to do it my way.
Every goddamn day.
Yeah. Every
goddamn day. Self-doubt all the time.
Yeah.
This whole goddamn 45 minutes I'm working on right now, none of it looks good. This is all bullshit.
No, no.
Why is this on paper? Like, how did I get laughs last week?
Yeah.
I feel like you got to be confident on stage and not confident with everything else you're doing, it'll make you work harder. If I'm not confident on that bit, then that makes me work on that. If I feel like, oh man, why is that funny? I don't feel funny today. Like, what?
Right.
What's going to switch that on?
Yeah.
And it'll make me put a little bit of work into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
Well, I'm like, you had to hit that wall.
Yeah.
Like, you're part of the community now.
But you know what? The thing is like, from day one, people, like, who mattered believed in me. And I let people who... Myself. Like, who am I, the expert? But, like, when, like, Bert liked me right away. And Jamie liked me right away. And I'm somebody's daughter, goddammit.
Yeah.
That makes me important.
Yeah, so, like, why am I the one to be like, I'm not doing this right when, like, Jamie Masada thinks I am? So, like, really credible people could sit there and be like, you can do this. And I would sit there being like, I can't do anything. But, yeah, I mean, I had a lot of shit to get over. I had a relapse with, like, eating disorders to get over. I had major, major shit come up and have to get over it. And it wasn't on the timeline everyone else wanted it to be on. And it didn't look like everybody else's road. Because everyone's so, like, this is what I want to do. This is all I want to do. This is all I do. And I was always like, can I do this if that doesn't apply to me? And also, I kind of just had to be
can
like,
I
yeah, I can.
And I'm kind of working on me right now.
Yeah, and I can be like, you know what, I can. Yeah, I can.
The beautiful thing about comedy is you can do it all your own way.
I was just going
to
say.
All of it, whether it takes you a million years to get there, you never get there, it takes you 3 years to get where you want to be.
I agree.
You can do it all your own way. It doesn't have to be anybody else's way.
And you write your own role.
And that's why I hate hearing comics say, oh man, it's going to be 3-4 more years before I can get into that show. Says fucking who?
Right, yeah.
Who says that? You're living rules by someone else's rules.
Everyone says when you start, like, it'll be 5 years before you get good.
It's 5 years before you get good. That's how I feel about it. Like, good luck to you in 5 years.
And it may not be 5 years before you have the album you want to record, but, like, it's not 5 years before you can work.
No.
And it's also the beautiful timing with Chicago is... We had to, like, because Laugh Factory was only a few years old, and then there was really just Zanies. There were a couple, there was Chalk.
You got Riddles.
There was CYSK. There was Riddles out in the Burbs. Yeah. There was the Improv and, you know, Shower. But there also wasn't this, like, New York loves stand-up, and there's a stand-up culture and audience
there. It's been ingrained there.
Yeah, the audience is, and so, but we had to, like, make our own shows, carnival bark them in off the sidewalks.
Yeah.
Be like, don't worry, it's not improv, because everyone's like, oh, I don't want to go to a show in a bar. Like, it's not improv. And they'll be like, okay, we'll come in.
That's how you start a movement, though.
Yeah, and so what it's like, we made our own stage time. We didn't wait for, there's X number of roles to be handed down from above. And this is something that I talk about with women a lot, is like, we need to write our own movies. I'm writing a screenplay right now. Like, we need to write our own shows, write our own stand-up, write for TV shows, because, like, we're not all actresses that are the same height, weight, eye color, waiting for one role that literally a man hands down from above, competing for that. And I've talked to Galati about this before. She was super nice to me when I first started at Zany's. And she was working there, and I was showcasing there. And she's like, listen, we're not the same person. Like, if they're booking you, they're not booking me, vice versa. And they're kind of like a... I feel like within, like, women who have been around for a while, we've actively sort of tried to be like, dude, like, who fucking cares? Like, if there's an off... Like, there's not one spot for a girl in each show, you know? And it's because we had to make our own fucking shows. Yeah. And it was our asshole friends that were making a show. And, like, heaven help them if they were like, we only put one girl on a show, you know? And that was kind of like a cool...
Well, part of it is in Chicago, the comics book the shows.
As opposed to
a booker or...
Yeah. You know. And being like, oh, we gotta fill this demographic.
Sorry, we got our quotas.
Yeah, and it was like, dude, three of the people who produced that show are... You know?